Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of conversations at the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. This week's episode focuses on the International Criminal Court. War criminals from South America to Rwanda to Kosovo have been prosecuted for their misdeeds. But what happens when perpetrators are shielded from prosecution by their governments? That's pretty common. In this hour, we'll hear from Alexis Koenig and Eric Stover of the Human Rights Center at the University of California, Berkeley, from Victor Peskin of Arizona State University, and they'll be in conversation with Judge Rebecca Westerfield. This event was recorded in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience. And now to our moderator, Judge Rebecca Westerfield.
I'd like to first of all introduce Alexa Koenig, who, in addition to her responsibilities as the Executive Director of the Human Rights Center at UC Berkeley, is also a member of the Technology Advisory Board of the Office of the Prosecutor for the International Criminal Court. She's also an author of many articles, and we also have, of course, Victor Peskin, who, in addition to his teaching responsibilities at Arizona, is, as you heard, a research fellow at UC Berkeley Human Rights Center, who has also authored many writings, including a very well-respected work on that was published by Cambridge Press on the international justice in the Balkans and Rwanda. And then to my immediate left here is Eric Stover, as you heard, who is the faculty director of the Human Rights Center at UC Berkeley. But one of the things for which Eric is much admired and known for is the medical forensic work that he did in the prosecution of the war crimes that came out of Yugoslavia. He is also very well known for research that he did on landmines, which really helped launch the international campaign to ban landmines, which, as some of you may know, received the Nobel Peace Prize in 1997. So thank you all again for being here this evening. It's a rather daunting subject, this how do we get justice in an unjust world? But I think a very good starting point is the book that these three have just co-authored, and it is called Hiding in Plain Sight, The Pursuit of War Criminals from Nuremberg to the War on Terror, published by the University of California Press. And I have to say, I thought it was an extremely good read. It's a terrific primer on the entire issue of the development of the international justice around war crime, and is a great start for the general reading public, I think, and students and all engaged citizens who are really interested in this topic. So let me start with some of the points that were made in the book, Eric, and let us talk a little bit about the evolution of war crime tribunals and criminal justice in the international criminal arena since Nuremberg.
Yeah. It really comes out of the ashes of the Holocaust, and that was the Allied powers, the United States and the other Allied powers, coming together and deciding that there would be a tribunal established to try those leading Nazis, the high-ranking Nazis, who they had captured at the time. So they had them in their custody. And that was in 1945, and then subsequently in 1946 was also an international military tribunal for Tokyo, for Japan, and the trials were held in Tokyo. One of the advantages that the Allied forces had is that they occupied Japan, they occupied Germany and the extended territories, so they were able to capture war criminals easily and bring them to justice. Some of them, as we know, like Adolf Eichmann, Joseph Mengele, and others, Klaus Barbie, fled to Latin America, and they weren't, some of them were not captured. At any rate, those trials took place until the end of the 40s, and it was in 1950 that the trials end, because of the scepter of the communist threat from the Soviet Union. The Allies felt that we were spending too much time with these trials was undermining the German economy and their sense of who they were. And so it was decided to stop the trials. And really at that point, international criminal justice went into the deep freeze of the Cold War. And it wouldn't emerge until the 1980s. And that began with the trial of the military junta in Argentina and extended to other trials in Latin America and to the establishment of the Yugoslavia Tribunal, which took place in 1994, after the genocide we saw in Bosnia. And similarly, a year later, another tribunal was established for Rwanda, and subsequently the juggernaut of international justice took off. There were tribunals in Sierra Leone, in Cambodia, Kosovo, and other countries. And eventually we ended up with the International Criminal Court, which began operating in 1998. And that's where we are today.
And that was a result of the Rome Treaty, as I understand it.
Yes. The International Criminal Court itself is a treaty body. It's agreed by a number of governments coming together. 122 signed the Rome Statute in 1998, and that created the court. It became operational several years later and has since then issued well over a dozen indictments and arrest warrants.
So you all talk about in your book, again, Hiding in Plain Sight, some of the challenges that the International Criminal Court has had, as well as some of its successes. So Victor, Alexa, would you like to address some of the challenges, the greatest challenges that you've seen in your studies of the International Criminal Court?
Sure. I think the greatest challenge that the ICC faces is that in comparison to the Nuremberg and Tokyo tribunals after World War II, that today's contemporary tribunals, the International Criminal Court or ICC, the Yugoslavia Tribunal, the Rwanda Tribunal as well, do not have an occupying force to make arrests. In fact, they do not have any arrest forces of their own to make arrests. So today's tribunals and the ICC in particular have to rely upon states and international organizations to arrest suspects and otherwise cooperate in the investigative process. And that creates a position of dependence upon these tribunals and the chief prosecutors and investigators. And it essentially leaves the tribunals at the mercy of states to cooperate or not, to arrest suspects or not. So on its face, the ICC in particular faces a daunting challenge to get suspects into custody. And all the tribunals do. And the book explores the politics and operational aspects of overcoming the challenges of a state cooperation. In comparison to the other contemporary tribunals that the UN has established, the International Criminal Court arguably faces an even greater challenge because states can choose to join the court to become state parties or not. So currently, we have about 124 state parties that are members of the court, but we have key powerful states that are not, such as the U.S., Russia, China, India, Pakistan, Indonesia, Turkey, Israel as well. And that creates a problem of cooperation. So you have 124 states that are supposed to cooperate and do not always do so, that we'll talk about later, I hope. And then you have some countries that don't have to cooperate but sometimes do. So it leads to a tremendous challenge in terms of arrests. And the key challenge is that suspects can hide in plain sight, like President Bashir of Sudan, who graces the cover of our book.
And so, Alexa, why don't you talk a little bit about the incident that came out of Kenya when the president had visited Kenya as an example of this challenge and arrest?
Well, I think one of the biggest challenges is really the size and scope and scale of the mandate of the International Criminal Court, and to some extent that's reflected in the situation in Kenya. The International Criminal Court is charged with going after the highest level war crimes perpetrators around the globe. And if you look at the Yugoslavia Tribunal, you look at the Rwanda Tribunal, you're looking at very defined geographic territories versus having to cover the entire globe with a very limited budget. If you look at the relative budget, and I think the finances of all of this often get lost in this conversation, but the ability of a court to investigate these kinds of crimes against the very highest level war crimes perpetrators, who are often much better funded than the court itself, becomes a real challenge, and that's something that you see play out. Of course, too, when you see a court going after the highest level war crimes perpetrators, the balance of power, even if you have more, 124 countries arguably behind the International Criminal Court, we're talking about going after people who have the resources of nations at their disposal and arguably have much better funded operations than what the court has.
I would just add, so with the particular incident in Kenya, it was in August of 2010. In 2007, 2008, Kenya had elections, which we all know were very violent, and there was a movement to adopt a new constitution. So in August, in Nairobi, in the capital, there was a great ceremony to bring out the new constitution. And Omar al-Bashir, who's the president of Sudan, like many other African leaders, flew into Nairobi now to attend the ceremony. Now, the problem is that Kenya is a signatory of the Rome Statute and legally obliged to arrest Omar Bashir because he was indicted in 2009 with crimes against humanity and a year later for genocide, for what happened in Darfur. What happens is al-Bashir arrives, he goes to the ceremony. He actually doesn't come into the main airport, Kenyatta International Airport. He goes to another airport so he can avoid being seen. He goes to the ceremonial grounds and he steps out of his vehicle and the crowds clap. But as journalists were watching this from behind their cameras, many of them in Nairobi were saying, what is going on? He's been indicted by the International Criminal Court. Why isn't he being arrested? And the response, he eventually leaves quickly, and the response by the Kenyan government was, this is how we do it in Africa. We are not going to, this is part of who we are, and we're not going to arrest one of our fellow heads of state. And this has now been repeated, where he has made visits, Omar al-Bashir, some 75 visits to over 20 countries, many of them signatories of the Rome Statute, and he has not been arrested. Most frequently, just 2 weeks ago, at the inauguration of Museveni, the president of Uganda, he was present, and he should have been arrested.
So that perfectly illustrates what you were talking about, Victor, in terms of the limitations around arrest powers. What other challenges has the ICC had to wrestle with?
Well, a key challenge is also getting cooperation for witness protection. So if we return back to Kenya, the ICC has opened a situation investigation in Kenya into the election violence from 2007-08, and indicted six individuals, three from each side of the conflict. And the ICC was quite confident at the time that successful prosecutions would occur. Eric and I visited Kenya in 2010 and saw a lot of optimism. As of a few months ago, all the charges have been dropped against all six suspects. And a key problem has been witness intimidation and coercion. Incidentally, in the Kenya situation, all six suspects were brought into custody. Actually, all six suspects appeared voluntarily under a court summons to The Hague, interestingly. So in the Kenya situation, you had overt cooperation in terms of the suspects surrendering themselves, but you had a defiance in terms of witness intimidation. So state cooperation is crucial from arrests to access to crime scenes and to witness protection, all kinds of aspects of the legal process.
What has been the ICC prosecutorial response to that challenge?
You know, maybe I'll hand it over to Alexa and Eric, who...
So I think one of them has really been to call states to task for not picking up this task of supporting the efforts of the ICC more aggressively. One of the themes that really comes out in the book is just how much politics plays a role. A big theme in the book is that there's really three things that you need in order to get a successful arrest. You need the legal infrastructure in place to be able to have the kinds of cooperation on a global scale that you need to effectuate an arrest and get someone into custody and ultimately prosecuted. But you also need the operational piece of it. You need to be able to find that person and actually get hold of that person. And then, of course, you have the political side of all of it. And as Eric and I believe Victor was mentioning earlier, of course, the states' parties to the Rome Statute, so the states that have agreed to participate with the International Criminal Court, have this requirement to cooperate with investigations and arrests. But sometimes politically, they see the court as just one of many tools that they're juggling in order to get their policy objectives met. And when they don't see arrests as being amenable to achieving those objectives, then you see this pushback. So you've seen the prosecutor in many instances recently really coming to the states and saying, unless you are willing to actually step it up and provide the support that we need to make this happen, we are going to let these cases go.
I would just add another difficulty the court has is these are high level. These are heads of state. These are commanders. And in those sorts of cases, you need insider witnesses. So you need witnesses who sat in the meeting and heard that the accused ordered genocide. And you need to get that person to the court and have them testify. So you have to set up a witness protection program. Well, it's not that easy to flip, as they say in the parlance, is to flip these guys and have them come forward to testify. So that's a challenge. The other is that often when crimes happen, you want to be on the scene quickly. You want to be there to document it. And you want physical evidence, you want to have documentary evidence, you want to take testimonies while they're fresh. And the court is unable to get its investigators into those countries immediately after atrocities take place. So that's another very big challenge that they have.
So where have you seen the successes of the ICC, and what's worked towards those successes beyond just the political objectives? Although you may want to give an example of that too, Alexa.
I'm trying to think of one of the more, well, obviously the Uganda cases, so the very first two trials that were in front of the ICC, they of course had their challenges. There were some criticisms about the kinds of charges that were brought. Certainly in the Lobanga trial, which was the first trial, not bringing sexual violence as a charge was seen as an issue when you had multiple witnesses talking about their experiences. But at the same time, we have actually seen a successful trial through to a conviction. And that's a huge accomplishment. I think the court is often criticized for the time frame. You know, we've now had the court in operation since 2002. The Rome Statute was signed originally put together in 1998. And a lot of people say, well, this has cost millions of dollars, and we've seen 14 years now with a small handful of convictions. Is it worth it? But if you look at the Yugoslavia tribunal, you look at the Rwanda tribunal, you look at some of the hybrid tribunals that have come previously, it takes time to build the capacity. We're building a court that has a global mandate, and we're trying to establish that infrastructure so that we can actually get these convictions to occur. And that's no easy task, particularly on the relatively small budget, as I was mentioning earlier, that they have compared to the earlier tribunals. I think a challenge that they're going to have, but also a potential success, is that as we are looking for new ways to ideally gather this evidence that Eric's talking about and build the link between the low-level crimes that are happening on the ground, the murders and the rapes, and the highest-level commanders, presidents of countries. We're seeing new tools and opportunities. One mechanism is to look at social media and the ways that you can develop connections between people through these new technologies. And as we go into increasingly sophisticated countries, we're going to find new challenges because those countries are so sophisticated. They can use those new technologies against the court, but there's also ways to be creative and leverage those opportunities in ways that we haven't previously.
If you were to identify the ideal prosecutor for the ICC, who would that be, and what did they do that made them the ideal prosecutor?
Well, we've only had two chief prosecutors at the ICC to date, Moreno Ocampo from Argentina and Ben Suda from Gambia. I would say that from our interviews and travels, what we hear time and again, not unanimously, but is Louise Arbour, the former Canadian jurist who is chief prosecutor of the UN Yugoslavia tribunals, often spoken of as the most distinguished strategic and ethical and effective chief prosecutor. It depends, though. She was very successful in terms of arrests, if we can return back to a great story of success, overtime success for arrests that she helped engineer, that does her a great credit. She took over from Richard Goldstone, the first chief prosecutor from South Africa. She took over as chief prosecutor of the UN Yugoslavia Tribunal in 1996 to 1999. And at that point, the tribunal had a crisis of effectiveness. It was a problem of trying to compel NATO peacekeepers who were in Bosnia following the Dayton Peace Accords to arrest suspected war criminals who were indicted, such as Radovan Karadzic and Ratko Mladic, and NATO, including the troops from the U.S., would not budge. And what Arbour did was she went to a common law enforcement tactic is to issue indictments under seal that could then be handed to NATO commanders, giving the NATO peacekeepers the element of surprise, reducing the risk of casualties to troops which that they feared. And that started a process of successful arrests on the part of NATO peacekeepers that put a lot of suspects into custody relatively early on in the life of the UN tribunal, turning it into an effective tribunal. So she helped engineer that process. Karadzic became a fugitive for 13 years and Ratko Mladic for 16. So in terms of thinking strategically about the politics and strategy of compelling political actors, she was key. It's not so easy for the ICC prosecutor to replicate these strategies, however.
Yes. I can just add one quick thing. I think, too, that for these prosecutors, you need someone who understands the politics that are being played on the global stage, but at the same time has the strength and the confidence to keep focused on these prosecutions, because every country that's involved in any of these cases is going to ultimately want to use the court for its political objectives. And that often is in tension with seeing successful prosecutions. So the individual who can hold up his or herself as someone who sees as their mandate actually prosecuting these crimes is someone who can actually keep the focus there and I think has a much better chance of seeing this through to fruition. At the same time, having to be sensitive to the fact that there is this tremendous dependency that's been built into the organism of the International Criminal Court.
So along those lines, how has politics played into the United States' cooperation or lack of cooperation with the ICC over the years? Well, they're not a signatory.
No, they're not a signatory. We could go on for a couple of hours on that question alone. What we see is the United States has become under the Obama administration, really a fair weather friend to the International Criminal Court, in that it will support chasing after Joseph Kony, who is the head of the Lord's Resistance Army in northern Uganda, and training and helping those African forces that are looking for him. Recently, when Museveni's inauguration 2 weeks ago, al-Bashir was in the audience, and Museveni said he welcomed al-Bashir, and he said, I used to support the court, but I don't anymore. They're a bunch of useless people. The delegates from the United States, Canada, and the European Union stood up and walked out. So it made a very strong statement. But ultimately, the United States needs to join the court. As Victor said earlier, other superpowers do. But that's not going to happen for quite a while.
And why won't that happen?
It's a complex, I think, a complex answer. I would say, first and foremost, there is a bit of American exceptionalism. We think that we can do this on our own, that there is fear that there are U.S. troops who serve overseas. Could they be detained and sent to The Hague and tried for potential war crimes? But when you look at the mandate of the court in the Rome Statute, that's not going to happen. It's in Congress, in this Congress, the atmosphere we have now, there's no way the Rome Statute is going to get ratified. So I think it's fairly bleak in the future. I don't know if my colleagues...
I would add it's very strategic in terms of how the United States has approached the International Criminal Court. I think if you look at the timing of when the court came into being in 2002, it was right after 9/11, and it was a period where the United States felt incredibly vulnerable and was trying to figure out its best positioning for how it was going to prevent another terrorist attack in the United States. So you see in 2002, right as the court's coming to fruition, also the passage of acts like the American Service Member Protection Act, also known colloquially as the Invade the Hague Act, where there was a desire on the part of the United States to maintain flexibility in terms of its response to the war on terror, and not want to be held up to any international body for the tactics that it chose.
What were the terms of that act?
The terms of that act were that if any U.S. service member was taken to the International Criminal Court for potential prosecution, the United States was declaring its right to go and invade The Hague militarily to bring that person out of the prisons in The Hague. We also started doing a number of practices like entering into bilateral immunity agreements where we would go to other countries and condition our financial support. We're obviously, as in the United States, one of the biggest fiscal supporters of nations around the world. We would condition that support on other countries signing pieces of paper that would say that they would never send a United States citizen to the International Criminal Court when that country was a party to the International Criminal Court. The legality of that is in tremendous conflict. People don't agree as to whether those are legal and what kind of how binding they would be under international law. But you can see this fear on the part of the United States in some ways about the potential of an international body ultimately taking away some of the sovereignty of the United States over its own citizens.
And so, Eric, one of the members of the audience has asked the question, can the ICC be successful if the United States does not agree to submit to the court's jurisdiction?
Well, I would say if the United States would join, if China would join, if Russia would join, and other superpowers, it would help the court tremendously. But that doesn't mean that the court is hamstrung by any means. It's just going to take longer. It's going to be more difficult to make the arrests. And so I don't think that would be a great boon for the court. But I think the way the court is now operating, one of the projects they're doing, in fact, we at the Human Rights Center are supporting them in this, is they're looking more to technologies, to trying to gather evidence through emails and finding out when perpetrators are giving out orders to their subordinates. These are all stored somewhere. and they can be brought forward and put in as evidence. And so I think as these technologies are advancing, the court itself is doing a much better job in its investigations. But I think it's still a long haul, and I think we're probably hopefully going to see at some point that Omar al-Bashir of Sudan will be arrested. His time is limited, and he needs to make a mistake and go to a country where they're prepared to arrest him, and this may actually take place. Some of the more recent arrests, Dominic Ongwen, who is a member of the Lord's Resistance Army, has been brought into custody, and he will stand trial. The Pierre Bemba case, a Congolese who was arrested in the Central African Republic, with charges of sex crimes were brought against him, and they held up. So, I mean, I think we're seeing some successes as well.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of conversations at the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We're hearing from Alexa Koenig and Eric Stover of the Human Rights Center at the University of California, Berkeley, along with Victor Peskin of Arizona State University. They're in conversation with Judge Rebecca Westerfield. This event was recorded in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience. And now back to our conversation.
Alexa, going back for a moment to some of the technologies that are being used, what are some of the more promising technologies that you identified for the prosecutor's office?
I think social media has become a huge boon, and looking carefully at the ways in which social media can draw connections between people is incredibly important. Linkage evidence, which is the evidence that you need to actually, as I was mentioning earlier, tie these high-level perpetrators to the actual crimes that are being committed on the ground, you have to establish those networks somehow. And increasingly, those networks are, you can demonstrate through relationships on Facebook or Twitter, or really any social media platform that you can think of, can become a way to establish that shape. Also for lead evidence, I mean, you've got videos that are now being posted from individuals all over the world about crimes as they're happening. So going back to this issue that Eric identified about the difficulty of the court getting on the ground quickly and in real time, there's a real potential there to tap into how many people now have access to tools that allow them to document crimes in real time. Of course, that brings up enormous challenges because of the rate at which we are videotaping crimes as they're happening is growing so exponentially. There's no way you can have a member of the court sitting there and going through, say, every video clip on Syria or for atrocities happening in other parts of the world and figuring out what's relevant to their caseload. And not only what's relevant, but then authenticating it to show that this isn't something that's been doctored for propaganda purposes. So that scale issue is something that we're increasingly going to be facing when it comes to international criminal justice. There are new practices like open source investigations, and I think there are a number of people who are looking at the ways those can be used to help aid in some of these war crimes prosecutions. Open source investigations is where you use publicly available resources that are in digital form to build the story of what has actually taken place. I think one of the things you see in the ICC's early years is that there was a tremendous dependence on witness testimony. And while witnesses will always be the lifeblood of any court case, because you need those very human stories, those witnesses become very vulnerable because, as Victor was mentioning, you can have intimidation, you can have people killed. But if you can back up their stories with some of these new forms of information that are coming to light, you arguably protect those witnesses who are coming to testify at tremendous risk to themselves. And you also build a story that is corroborated so that hopefully the defendant, if he or she is truly guilty, cannot poke holes and ultimately pull that witness apart on the stand.
Yeah, and sure. I might add to that as well is when Muammar Gaddafi, the arrest warrant, the International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant against Muammar Gaddafi. They had a problem at the Office of the Prosecutor in The Hague, and that was all of a sudden they were inundated with video clips and thumb drives with all of this evidence, and they weren't able to go through it and see what was valid evidence that could eventually be used. And as a result, that's one of the reasons they've turned to us at the Human Rights Center, is to get to go to Silicon Valley, to go to get these technologists there, to go and work with them in the court and improve their ability to go through all of this evidence and be able to make it court admissible so it'll actually hold up.
Is Silicon Valley responsive to this?
Yes, we've had, in fact, Alexa and the head of our technology and human rights program, Keith Hyatt, have a number of meetings, and we've had technologists from Silicon Valley and elsewhere who we've taken over to The Hague, who will spend several weeks working with the prosecutors to improve their ability to assess and use this evidence.
I think there's an important distinction that needs to be made, too, because I know obviously in the media there's been a lot of concern about the ways that governments can use these different platforms to gather information prospectively and spy on people. This is a very different situation in that when you're talking about the International Criminal Court, you're talking about individuals being investigated who have actually been charged with a crime, and there's an indictment out against them. So it's very specific to particular individuals. It's not looking prospectively at possible wrongdoing. It's looking at wrongdoing that has occurred and investigating that. So it's usually very narrow. And these tools ultimately become... Oh, the other thing I would add to that is that in many cases, what the court is trying to do is actually be a resource for survivors of human rights abuses and of war crimes when their own countries are refusing or unable to take up those cases themselves. So this is sort of a court of last resort. Instead of empowering those governments to oppress citizens, the bigger objective is to empower those citizens and those survivors to sometimes stand up to some of the most powerful countries in the world.
So the ICC has also had complicated relationships with some of the African nations, which has perhaps impacted its credibility. Would you like to address that, Victor?
Sure. Some people call it an African court and use that in a pejorative sense in terms of an anti-African court. And you hear that criticism again and again, and it has dogged the ICC. It's dogged the ICC because the ICC... The International Criminal Court is supposed to be a global court. And so the criticism, particularly from African heads of state, is that it's solely focused on Africa to subjugate Africa. And this is a complicated issue. There are a number of sound purposes for why the court has only focused on Africa so far. Some of the worst human rights abuses under the jurisdiction of the ICC have occurred there. Also, the ICC operates under the principle of complementarity, and complementarity essentially allows states the first right to prosecute human rights abuses, but failing to do that, the ICC can come in. So weaker judiciaries, such as in Africa, often become subject to ICC investigations. And so, interestingly, though, the chief prosecutor has opened up her first investigation outside of Africa into the Russian-Georgian war from 2008, and she opened up that in January of 2016. So we may see indictments in that case, and that could be highly politically charged. The prosecutors also opened up a preliminary investigation into the Israel-Palestinian conflict as well.
And that chief prosecutor again is whom and from where?
Fatou Bensouda from Gambia.
Okay.
And the criticism essentially is that the chief prosecutor, who's African now, picks on Africa because it's politically easier to get states to cooperate. And in comparison, if you go to the Russians to cooperate and hand over Russian citizens, it's politically charged. Israel-Palestine politically charged. Afghanistan politically charged. So it returns to the issue of the court not having enforcement powers and having to rely on states to cooperate. And if you go into geopolitically a difficult terrain, you're going to have problems in terms of arrests. But even in Africa, it's extremely difficult sometimes to get states to hand over suspects.
Alexa?
I think there's also, you have to look at who's complaining that they focus too much on Africa. One of the things that the Human Rights Center at Berkeley Law has done is spoken to a lot of the survivors of the conflicts that have taken place in these nations. And the people who are often complaining that the ICC is spending too much time in Africa are themselves the heads of state who are being investigated by the court. Many of the survivors with whom researchers at the Human Rights Center and other places have spoken with have said that they appreciate the court, and the court is really their only chance to balance out the imbalance of power that happens when heads of state are arguably abusing or have abused the population at large.
So it's still viewed as a force in that area of the world.
Well, I think you could, an example would be 2 years ago in South Africa, and Omar al-Bashir of Sudan, under indictment, travels to a meeting of the African Union in Johannesburg in South Africa. Word got out that he was coming. A local non-governmental organization, a human rights organization there, began working to get a court to order his arrest. Now, the South African government is a signatory and one of the early strong supporters of the International Criminal Court. When al-Bashir arrives, the NGO gets the petition into the court. The court issues an arrest warrant for him, or that he should be brought into custody. But the government gets him onto his plane, and he leaves South Africa and goes back to Khartoum. So what you're seeing in Africa, too, it's not only, as Alexa saying, it's the survivors of mass violence, but also this network of local NGOs that are using their own strategies to get, if their governments are not going to make the arrests, then they're going to work and try and work through the courts to see that happen.
So I want to move to something a little different, unless you want to add anything else about the ICC. And you kind of touched on it, Alexa, when you talked about accountability. And that is the tension between peace versus justice and how that plays out sometimes in some of these war-torn areas. I know in your book you specifically stated, for instance, and I think you alluded to it earlier, that NATO feared that arrest of war crimes suspects would jeopardize the fragile peace in the Balkans at the time, as one example. On the other hand, in Rwanda, that was an incident where it was important to have justice as a precondition to peace. So I wonder if we could talk about this a bit more.
Sure. I think the peace and justice debate is extremely volatile in academia and among activists. And you know, there are situations where the pursuit of justice may undermine the pursuit of stability and democratization. For instance, we can see an example that we discuss in Serbia. In March 2003, Zoran Djindjic, the moderate leader of Serbia, took a courageous decision to arrest his own people, to hand them over to the Yugoslavia tribunal, such as Slobodan Milosevic. And he was assassinated largely because a certain war crime suspects feared arrest. And so that potentially destabilized Serbia. It did not in the end, but the chief prosecutor, Carla Del Ponte, had been blamed with undermining Serbia's stability. Is that true or not? In the end, it didn't turn out to be. The argument is that that if you do not have justice, you won't have peace, that if you do not remove the indicted war criminals from the political scene, it will undermine a stability and rule of law. In the short term, it was hard for people to see that in Serbia. In the long term, I think she won her argument. It's not always the case. So we can go to the situation of the ICC's indictment of Muammar Gaddafi in 2011 as kind of a counterexample in the peace and justice debate. The UN Security Council voted unanimously in February 2011 to refer the unfolding violence there to the ICC. The ICC came in, had tremendous international support from ICC state parties and from the superpowers. The U.S. supported it, Russia supported it, China supported it, and the idea was for the Security Council states to use the ICC as a political tool to marginalize Muammar Gaddafi. But then a few months into the war, what happened was it was hard to defeat Gaddafi militarily, and he had just been indicted. So there, this indictment seemed to imperil NATO's military intervention to oust Gaddafi. So at that point, you had the shift where those who had supported the indictment of Gaddafi all of a sudden said, look, this will have him dig in his heels and not give up, right? And on the table at the time had been an offer to Gaddafi to give him exile to a non-party state of the ICC, right? So like perhaps to an African state, not a party to the ICC. So there, many diplomats believed that the pursuit of justice undermined the pursuit of peace. Yet these were the same people who advocated a few months earlier the prosecution of Gaddafi. So these two examples from Serbia and here show how complicated the peace and justice debate is. It takes time, it takes determination to sift through the facts. But at the same time, you'll see today a particular among certain African heads of state who use the peace and justice argument politically to try to stave off a pressure for arrest and will claim we don't want to hand over suspects because it will undermine peace and stability. So it's used strategically and cynically sometimes as well to defy legal obligations.
And so the issue's framed in a way, in a particular way, to advance a particular position. How would you frame the issue, Eric?
Of justice versus peace? Mm-hmm. Well, I think what...
Because I don't think we like that framing, right?
No, justice we don't. Versus peace. And I think that's what Victor is getting at, is facts matter. Mm-hmm. And when you get into these sorts of debates between justice versus peace, people tend to go up onto platitudes. And you have to look at each incident and see, well, did the pursuit of justice here really hinder peace? It may have on some occasions, others it may not have. And a very good example of that is going back to the former Yugoslavia and the signing of the Dayton Peace Accords in the end of 1995. Then NATO troops go into Bosnia, and they were very reluctant, as we said earlier, to make arrests. And they were reluctant because they felt this was a fragile peace. And also, only a few years earlier, American soldiers, some 16, 17, had been killed and injured in Mogadishu during trying to make a capture there. At the time as well, you could go to the American public and say, who is Radovan Karadzic, who was the president of the Serbian Republic in Bosnia? And 20% of the population didn't know who he was. So it wasn't an issue that troops wanted to pursue. But what Luis Arbour did by having a sealed indictment, she took the problem of confrontation between troops making arrest of a war criminal where there could be potentially a shootout and used the element of surprise. And so gradually the troops agreed to carry out the arrests. And you found that World War III didn't take place. And it was a learning curve. And that's the important thing, is that both high and U.S. military and on the ground realized we can't actually carry out these arrests. And the British and the French as well. In the end, some six special forces units were sent in to make arrests in Bosnia from six different countries. And so we had a turnaround because we realized that this wasn't going to destroy the peace. You can look now at Sudan, and even though the peace has not come to Sudan, and it doesn't have anything to do with the arrest warrants, at least in my view, it's the fact that Omar al-Bashir believes he can continue to suppress his opponents. He can continue to carry out the crimes, which he is, in Darfur. So the idea that all of a sudden peace is going to bring around happiness and a return to normalcy isn't often the case. Peace negotiations don't necessarily do that. But you have to look at each incident and judge it on those merits, I think.
Alexei, you want to add anything to that?
I think there's also a temporal dimension to it. So you have to look, sometimes it makes sense to arrest as those crimes are occurring to remove certain people from positions of power where they can do great injustices towards other people. But sometimes it's also a case of a longer time frame where maybe you need things to stabilize a little bit and for those high-level people, for their power to wane or their supporters to eventually fade away so that you can get the arrests and establish an historical narrative around what happened. As Eric said, around facts mattering. One of the great contributions of courts can often be to create an historic record of what's happened when the facts around what's occurred are greatly in dispute. And that dispute between what's happened in the past is often what leads to future conflict. So there's a great quote, and I wish I could remember who said it, that there is no such thing as a beginning or an end to conflict, that it's all one long conflict that keeps re-erupting over time. So if you can begin, people won't necessarily agree on the record that the court develops, but it's at least one record that can become a dominant voice that people can ultimately shape their past around, so they're looking a little bit more in concert for the future.
So let's talk about a very current conflict, which is Syria. There's a question from the audience that says, we're witnessing in Syria the greatest war crimes of the 21st century, with more than 250,000 people murdered, primarily civilians. What, if anything, is the ICC doing to document these crimes? And can the ICC claim legitimacy if it fails to confront what is happening there?
I think that's an area where you really see tremendous promise in the friends of the ICC, and I'm saying friends quite broadly, being so important to what the International Criminal Court can do down the line. Because right now, the court isn't empowered to necessarily investigate or take on Syria, but there are a number of different groups who are gathering that evidence right now as we speak. And the United States State Department is helping in that effort so that when the time comes, there will be those documents saved and there will be that evidence so that the ICC can ultimately, ideally, be successful in any prosecutions that emerge.
So let me touch on another huge issue, which is the refugee crisis and the international response to that. What is happening that is effective, in your view, with using international criminal justice principles in protecting refugees or asserting their rights? Anything?
I think that connection is yet to be made. I don't see...
Does that surprise you that we've had this crisis for as long as we have had now and that's not happened?
I think there's a void. I think there's absolutely a void in looking at state responsibility to individuals who are fleeing conflict and some of the worst situations. A lot of times when you're talking about international criminal justice, you're focused very much on, yes, mass crimes have occurred, but who is the one individual who's responsible or the five individuals who are most responsible for that crisis? It's really focused on that defendant and not on solving these bigger structural problems and challenges. So I think one of the issues that we face in the international criminal justice legal framework is sometimes expecting too much of courts and not really holding to what they do and what they do well. When we ask too much of courts, we stretch them so thin that they ultimately can't put their resources towards that individual criminal liability and prosecutions. That said, I do think there's an emerging narrative that states have a responsibility and state leaders have a responsibility to respond in a responsible way to what people are experiencing on the ground and to find a way to take care of the people who are fleeing conflict situations. And I have not seen, at least in my experience, a tremendous amount of leadership on that front.
Well, let me close with asking you a question again from the audience here, which is, why did you write this book, In Plain Sight?
Well, I think we each have our personal stories. Mm-hmm. We've all worked together for many years, and it's been a wonderful collaboration writing the book. I can tell you a personal story, and it actually only occurred to me recently. I was involved in, it was in June of, I'm gonna get the date right, it was in June of 1986, and the purported remains of Joseph Mengele, the Nazi doctor at Auschwitz, had been found in Brazil, and I was part of a team that went to examine the skeleton and to see if indeed these were the remains of Mengele. And at one point, standing with some of my colleagues, I had previously, in the months before, been exhuming the graves and identifying the victims of the disappeared in Argentina. And here we were looking at the remains of victims. And here, a few months later, I'm looking at the remains of Joseph Mengele. And it really struck me as to how was it that this man, who committed such horrendous crimes at Auschwitz concentration camp, left in January of 1945, and here we are so many years later, and he was never captured. So it was a kind of sense, how did they get away with it? And then I think for all of us, as we've worked closely either investigating war crimes, studying these courts, and when we look at what people write about them, nobody was really focusing on the whole operations, legal and political aspects of arrests. And until you have arrests, you will not have trials. You will not have international criminal justice. So, and justice for the victims. So we kind of felt that this was a missing part of the story that we needed to research.
Alexa?
For me, honestly, in the beginning, I've told Eric this story. He sat me down in his office one day, and I was finishing up my dissertation, and we just finished this big study on Guantanamo and speaking with former detainees. And he's like, I have this great idea for a book, and I think Victor's in, and we're going to study arrests. And I remember thinking, I have absolutely no idea why that's interesting, and I have no idea why that's important, because people are arrested all the time. But I figured if Eric was saying it was important, I would just jump on board, and I would learn. And I did learn incredibly quickly that, as Eric said, if you don't have bodies, if you don't have the individuals to hold responsible for these crimes, what's the point of having these courts? And we were beginning to see so many different ways that governments were actually actively helping some of the world's most notorious war criminals escape because they wanted something from those people, whether it was their scientific knowledge, or they thought they could be a tool later down the line. Or you saw people who were just brazenly living out in the open, in some ways almost mocking the horrors that their victims had gone through. And you have individuals who are looking at their neighbor who's committed tremendous crimes against their family members, and you become incredibly frustrated that governments, that people with so much power can ultimately experience so much impunity, and there has to be a better way for moving forward.
Victor.
So Eric and I went to Kenya and Uganda in summer of 2010. We were speaking to people and interviewing people about the potential of the International Criminal Court in Kenya, and when we got back, it was the inauguration of the Kenyan Constitution, and Eric called me or emailed me because of this scene in terms of Bashir arriving to celebrate the new Kenyan Constitution, the cover of the book, Hiding in Plain Sight. And this became the kind of seed, the puzzle to figure out how could a state party that pledged adherence to the laws of the International Criminal Court could inaugurate its own constitution, undermining the rule of law. And we pursued the politics and legal aspects of that, all three of us, back from 2010 to the present.
And we're very glad that you did. I think the book, again, In Plain Sight, is really a great service and a testament to your all's ongoing work. I know each of you individually, and I know how dedicated you are, and we've just really appreciated your sharing this with us this evening. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've just heard from Alexa Koenig and Eric Stover of the University of California, Berkeley, Victor Peskin of Arizona State University, and their conversation with Judge Rebecca Westerfield. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. This broadcast is made possible weekly by the generous support of Chevron. Additional funding for post-production is provided by Maria Starr. She's a member of the KQED Producers Circle. Our recording engineer is Robert Zimmerman. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.